Good morning. My name is Pamela All. I am Vice President for Domestic Programs in the Education and Training Center here at USIP, and I'm very happy to welcome you to this policy forum on children and armed conflict. We have a very full agenda, and it is really divided into several areas. One, looking at the problem, but then, more importantly, looking at what can be done about the problem. And we are continually astonished by the complexity of this problem of children in armed conflict, because you really have a situation in which non-state actors are waging wars against individuals using the children, the sons and daughters and the nieces and nephews of those individuals, as weapons of war. So what roles that can governments and big international organizations play in this? And, you know, how do you intersect with something that's happening so much at the grassroots as well as at other layers? So we are very happy to be able to collaborate today with the Department of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, and we are particularly pleased to be able to welcome our board member, David Kramer, who is dual-hatted because he also sits on USIP board, and to collaborate with his department at State. I want to thank especially my colleague, David Smith, who worked on this from the USIP's point of view, and Tu Dang, who worked on it from DRL's point of view. I know it's taken both of you a lot of time and effort to bring this program together, but I think it will be really excellent. The agenda spells out today's activities, and I think you all have a copy of it. We will be having lunch at 1, and the program will end around 5. And I do want to remind you before we start the program to please turn off your cell phones. Even if they're on mute or silence or whatever, they interfere with the microphone system, and you'll be able to hear them. So if you'll just turn them off, that would be great. To open the program, we are going to hear both from the president of the Institute, Richard Solomon, and David Kramer. Let me introduce the president for those of you who do not know him, which I imagine are very, very few of you here in this room, because he has had an illustrious career both at the State Department and at the U.S. Institute of Peace. At the State Department, he was Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. And at USIP, he has led our effort to turn the Institute into a rather small and private organization, private in terms of its outreach effort, to one that will have a big national presence on the Mall. And I think the commitment of this government to peace through the U.S. Institute of Peace owes a great vote of thanks to Dick Solomon, who has made it possible. So with that, Dick, I'll turn to you.
Yes, when we're in that building across from the State Department, we'll have even more room for programs like this. Although the one thing we're worrying about is this is a fairly easy location to get to. We're right around the corner from Think Tank Row. We're just down from DuPont Circle, and it'll be a little more complicated to get to our new location, but we're looking at that, shuttle buses and pneumatic tubes and all the things that can speed your way to our new site, which will open in a little over 2 years. I want to reinforce what Pamela said about how pleased we are that David Kramer, our board member representing the Secretary of State, is with us today to pick up on an issue that we've been working with for most of the decade of 2000. We began the most visible period of activity in this area with a very high-profile program where we had the film actor Michael Douglas who was a United Nations special envoy for dealing with the issue of child soldiers, present a film that he had worked on. But this is an issue that has involved our Jennings Randolph Fellowship Program. We had Betty Bigambi, a former Ugandan government official, with us for over a year. She's done negotiations trying to deal with the, with this terrible problem. It really is a vicious issue. And I was just reading in the morning Washington Post a really heartrending account of suicide bombers in Iraq, and it not only involves the manipulation of the mentally ill, of women who have lost their husbands in the conflict and are seeking revenge, but also children who are fitted out with suicide vests and unwittingly sent off to a situation and somebody detonates their vest from a distance, obviously killing the children. So this is in many, many ways a really terrible problem, and we're pleased to work not only with the State Department but with the United Nations. And we're especially honored today to have with us today the UN Secretary General Special Representative for Children in Armed Conflict, Radhika Kumaraswamy, and we'll be hearing from her momentarily. We've also looked at this problem through our National Peace Essay Contest. Each year we have high school kids write essays on issues of particular importance to war and peace, and the problem of child soldiers and how to both prevent the problem and reintegrate children who have been brought into conflict situations was one of our more appropriate, I was going to say interesting, that's not quite the right word, issues that we've worked at. So we appreciate your being with us this morning, and David and Ms. Kumaraswamy, we're very pleased that you could help us work and raise the visibility of this this problem. Thank you.
And now we will hear from David Kramer, Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor. He has been working in the democracy area for a very long time as an expert on Russia and Eurasia, and has been, before he was at the State Department, at the Carnegie Endowment and at CSIS, working on transitional democracy issues. And we are very pleased that he took such great interest in this program. I'm not sure without his endorsement and push that we would be here today, so we're delighted that you're with us.
Thank you very much, Pamela, for the introduction, and my real thanks to you and Dick and David Smith also for the great job in putting this program together, but also for the terrific job you do in general on many issues, but on this issue in particular, this issue being a very important one and why we have such an impressive turnout here today. It is a real pleasure for me to be here. As you mentioned, I am dual-hatted, both as the Assistant Secretary for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor at the State Department, but also as the Secretary of State's representative on the USIP board, and I'm delighted to be here in both capacities. Let me, in addition to expressing my real thanks to USIP for helping us pull this event together, let me also acknowledge three people from my bureau, if I may. Jeff Krilla, who is the Deputy Assistant Secretary in DRL with responsibility for this issue as well as for many other issues. James Varai, who's the director in the office that handles this issue. And also Tu Dang, who, as you mentioned, was instrumental in our bureau in pulling today's event together. And we have other colleagues from DRL here, too. I wish to thank them for helping out and pitching in. I also want to join in the welcome for Radhika Kumaraswamy, the Secretary General Special Representative for Children in Armed Conflict. Real pleasure for you to join us here today. I'm really pleased that you're able to make it. And I think, if I am correct, I also want to wish you a happy birthday. So many, many more. but really very nice of you to join us. I also want to extend appreciation for representatives from other governments who I see, at least based on the cheers, will be joining us at certain points throughout the day, governments of Burundi and France, Afghanistan, Cote d'Ivoire, Indonesia, Philippines. So a terrific turnout by our colleagues from other governments. Fellow colleagues from the U.S. Department of Labor, U.S. Agency for International Development, Department of Defense, this is a real interagency effort, and we're very proud of that. Representatives, of course, from international organizations, and just as important, representatives from the NGO community and civil society. Without the work that you folks do, we wouldn't be able to do our jobs. Let me also acknowledge Ricky Richard Anuar, a former child soldier from Uganda, for sharing his experience here today and for his efforts to help former child soldiers reintegrate back into their communities through his NGO, Friends of Orphans in Uganda, which happens to be the 2008 recipient of the Harriet Tubman Reintegration Freedom Award, jointly given by the Free the Slaves and the Templeton Foundation. So our sincere congratulations to Ricky and his organization. Why is this issue important to us? Why are we here today? As Assistant Secretary in the Bureau for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, part of my mandate and the mandate of all those who work in the Bureau is to protect and promote human rights throughout the world. And the problem of child soldiering is a human rights issue, and it's an urgent priority for the U.S. government, as well as, I'm pleased to say, for many other governments and many NGO organizations, too. My bureau engages on this issue through efforts to promote the rights of children and to combat the worst forms of child labor. We first seek to raise awareness about the problem. This conference is instrumental in that effort. We publish the annual report, the Country Reports on Human Rights Practices, which reports on human rights issues broadly, but also includes discussion of the recruitment and use of child soldiers. The 2007 report highlighted the problem of child soldiering in 30 countries and described child soldier recruitment and use by non-state groups in 21 countries. These reports, of course, are available on the State Department website. In addition to participation in direct armed hostilities, children are forcibly used for other purposes that are considered the worst forms of child labor, including laying mines and explosives, scouting, spying, acting as decoys, couriers, or guards, logistic and support functions as porters, cooks, and domestic laborers, and sadly also for sexual exploitation. Now, this issue has been reported on by the U.S. government, as well as by international organizations, a variety of NGOs and academics, and many others, some of whom will be speaking here during the conference today. The purpose of this forum is to contribute to a deeper understanding of the problem of child soldiering and the emerging global trends and its implications for policy and programming, as well as to develop a common understanding of the best policies and practices to effectively address the problem and improve the programs we currently have in place. We are doing the best we can, but obviously it is not enough. It is still a serious problem throughout the world. In my bureau, one of the tools we use is to promote respect for human rights through technical assistance. And I'm pleased to share with you that the Bureau for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor is funding two new projects in Burundi to reintegrate former child soldiers into their communities, particularly girl soldiers. And we intend to focus on the problem of child soldiers with additional program resources in the near future. We look forward to working with the government of Burundi. I'm very pleased the ambassador is here today, and on other projects, as well as with other governments that will be represented. DRL also works with other entities at the Department of State, including the Office for Trafficking in Persons and others, as well as other U.S. agencies to help improve coordination on this issue. And in addition to co-hosting events like the one today, we engage in and support a variety of activities to promote the sharing of information, knowledge, expertise, and experience. As new trends emerge, there's a need to transform the way we address the issue of child soldiers. to improve coordination among like-minded governments, and to be well-informed about this issue as we move forward to addressing the problem. Our objective is to learn from one another. By bringing all of your experiences and expertise together here today, our intent is to generate both a greater understanding of the problem and to explore innovative ideas to improve policies and assistance activities to promote sustainable and healthy lives for children and young adults affected by war. As you will hear today, children are both combatants and victims as a result of child soldiering, but most importantly, former child soldiers and other children who have been affected by war are survivors. We view today's forum as an extremely important milestone in our continued engagement and in our efforts to address this problem of child soldiering, and I very much appreciate your all coming here today. Thank you. And I apologize. I have to go to a meeting at the department, but I will try to be back, and my colleagues here will be here all day, too. And again, many thanks. Thanks.
Thank you, David.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I'm now very pleased to introduce Radhika Kumaraswamy, who is, as you have heard, a special representative for children in armed conflict at the UN. And in this role, she really serves as the world's voice on this issue. This is the person who has probably done as much as Michael Douglas and all others combined to bring to our attention the problems that the world faces in having children used as components of war. Before she came to the UN, she was chairperson of the Sri Lankan Human Rights Commission, and she was director of the International Center for Ethnic Studies in Sri Lanka. And a very prominent human rights advocate, has written very broadly on human rights issues, including violence against women, violence in the family, and problems of international trafficking. And I became aware of her reputation in 2002 when I went to Sri Lanka. And before I left, lots of people came to me and said, well, you must see if you can get an appointment with Radhika. And somehow they didn't use your last name. It was always with Radhika. And when I was in Colombo, everyone said to me, well, of course, you are going to see Radhika, aren't you? And when I came back, everyone said, well, of course, you did see Radhika, didn't you? So I realized that that was probably the most important appointment I had while I was in Colombo. So we are very pleased that she has agreed to spend the day with us and to be our keynote speaker on this issue. Radhika, thank you.
Mr. Solomon, Ms. Al, ladies and gentlemen, it is a great pleasure for me to be here today, and I thank the U.S. Institute for Peace for taking the effort to organize this day of discussion. I see some new faces and some old friends, and I hope we will engage in a thoughtful dialogue that will move the agenda forward. I'm also happy to be in Washington days after the Senate passed the Child Soldiers Accountability Act. The act criminalizes the recruitment and use of child soldiers and gives the United States the authority to deny admission or to deport individuals for such activities. I notice the first panel of today's discussion is dedicated to understanding the use and abuse of child soldiers in the world today. Many member states, particularly from the developing countries, want us to focus attention on the root cause of this practice. Why does it happen, and what can we do to prevent it? In my experience in conflict zones where there are child soldiers, I have gained some insights into why this practice takes place. In many regions, particularly in the civil wars of Sierra Leone, Uganda, and Liberia, children were often abducted from their families and turned into fighters. The movie Blood Diamond and the recent powerful movie Johnny Mad Dog capture this terrible pattern of abduction, brutalization, and use. Children are not only beaten into submission, they are administered drugs and generally terrorized into becoming soldiers. In other contexts, the phenomenon of child soldiers is more complex, where children join for motivational reasons linked to their political context, either for ethnic or political loyalty, where their community is under threat. These are different challenges for the child protection worker and for the rehabilitation of the child soldier, who sees himself as a warrior and hero in the style of the adults, and where being a soldier is central to their identity. Child soldiering occurs for a variety of reasons, and there is a great deal of debate on this matter. There are, of course, the structural factors which create a framework for abuse and exploitation. Poverty is a major reason, and children or families are drawn to armed groups so that children will be given a meal and shelter. This is particularly true of countries with a large number of vulnerable children and families. Discrimination is another reason, where children who are from ethnic, tribal, and class groups that are discriminated against and humiliated often join what they see as movements of liberation. War creates a situation of militarization, and as the conflict persists, everyone tends to become part of the militarized process, involved with one armed group or the other. The proliferation of small arms may also contribute to child soldiering. It takes a child an average of 45 minutes to master AK-47, and they are all now freely available in the theaters of war. Then there are the motivational factors that drive child soldiering. The motivation of leaders, who know that children make great soldiers, is probably the single most important factor. With underdeveloped notions of death, children are fearless in combat, seeing everything as a game. Leaders deliberately and purposefully exploit the children with a cynical disregard for their welfare. This cruelty is the reason why most of us are campaigning against the impunity that may attach to their actions. On the part of children, motivational factors that move them to join armed groups may be ethnic, class, or tribal loyalty, or the desire for vengeance, especially when they have seen family members killed and raped before their eyes. In war, the armed young soldier also becomes a role model, something to aspire to, someone who commands respect because he carries a gun. This model of masculinity is then the one to emulate, and generations of young men also begin to accept that masculinity must come with violence. A recent ILO-IPEC study on Congo, the DRC, and Rwanda found that 34% of children joined armed groups for material need, 21% for ideology, 15% out of fascination, and 10% because of vengeance. Around 11% joined because they wanted to leave home. Only 9% joined because of fear. It is also interesting to discuss how we define child soldiers and what groups of children are covered by this description. Recently, our office filed an amicus curiae before the International Criminal Court, asking the court to adopt a case-by-case approach and rely on a functional test so that the full gamut of children's experience of being associated with armed groups is taken into account. This is particularly true of girl children who play multiple roles as combatants, as wives, sex slaves, or domestic aides. They are often left out of DDR programs because they are not seen as child soldiers when their association with the armed group is usually quite extensive. One cannot underestimate the importance of the International Criminal Court, the Special Tribunal of Sierra Leone, and Security Council Resolution 1612 in fighting against impunity for those who recruit and use child soldiers. Security Council Resolution 1612 is the Security Council's only proactive engagement with a thematic human rights issue. It sets up a Security Council working group and a monitoring and reporting mechanism in countries of concern, a UN system-wide effort with the help of its partners. It also points to the possibility of targeted measures against recalcitrant recruiters. The importance of these initiatives struck a chord in me during recent trips to the field. In the Central African Republic, I met with Commandant Laurent of the APRD. Initially, he did not know that he was on the list of annexes, called the List of Shame, of the latest Secretary General's report, and was quite belligerent. But when I explained to him the possible consequences of the resolution, including targeted measures, he changed his mind and agreed to hand over the children according to an agreed process. UNICEF informed me 2 weeks ago that he has so far identified 250 children and is ready to start releasing them. When I met non-signatories to the Darfur Agreement, the first question on their mind was the International Criminal Court and the implications for them. Deterrence and enforced compliance are very important tools in this struggle against the practice of child soldiers. There are scholars who argue that this punitive legislative approach is misplaced and that child soldiering is an age-old practice and that we should try and deal with it through persuasion and cultural dialogue. Though constructive engagement is important, this is true about all human rights abuses. They have all been practiced in the past and received a measure of tolerance. The point of international conventions and treaties is to say enough is enough. Children will not be abused and exploited in this manner. Accountability then becomes a means for enforcing these standards. In addition, we must not forget the victims in this process. In the Central African Republic, I met three generations of women in one family who had been raped by Mr. Bemba's forces when they overran Bangui. The youngest was just 10 years old when she was attacked. When I met them, they were in a jubilant mood, ready to go to The Hague to testify before the ICC, to vindicate themselves and to fight for justice. One need only to meet these victims to know that international justice is the right way to go and that it sends a very strong signal that certain practices will not be tolerated. Legislation at the national level is also a crucial component for accountability. The recent initiatives of the Child Soldiers Prevention and Accountability Acts now going through Congress is a welcome effort and gives impetus to worldwide attempts to eradicate the practice of child soldiers. Some countries such as DRC have also adopted national legislation to deal with this issue. Beyond the tools of punishment, there are other methods of constructive engagement which allow us to reach the children before any judicial process. The Security Council endorsed the use of action plans for the release of children in its Resolution 1339 of 2004. UN agencies are entrusted with the task of entering into action plans with parties recruiting and using child soldiers. These time-bound plans spell out concrete modalities for the release of children, including procedures for verification. In Côte d'Ivoire, the threat of Resolution 1612 resulted in all five parties to the conflict entering into action plans with the UN and releasing the children. All parties in Côte d'Ivoire are now delisted from the annexes to the Secretary-General's report as a result of this. Of course, these are the success stories. There are many parts of the world where the recruitment and use of children continue with impunity, and we have only touched the top of the iceberg. But at least today we have the tools with which to be more effective, if we just make the effort. To truly succeed with action plans, however, we must be given the freedom to talk to parties recruiting the children, and this requires that states give us access to these parties. Many governments are short-sighted and forfeit the future of the children, arguing that any meeting between the parties and the UN would give legitimacy to the non-state actor. As a result, they prevent the UN from moving forward. Rescuing children is a laudable goal, but that is only the beginning. The real struggle is the successful reintegration of these children back into the communities. Our field officers report that this is not as successful as we would like. Experience of the past decade point to certain principles that are essential in the reintegration of children. These are codified in the form of the Paris Principles adopted in 2007. Any attempt at reintegration must involve inclusive community-based programming, recognizing that programs must be directed toward all children in the community. This is more effective because it prevents stigmatization of former child soldiers and helps community workers develop the community with the child. Unless this is done, unless we work with the community and the parents, children find it very difficult to reintegrate successfully. Most research studies show that the clue to a child's successful reintegration is family and community acceptance. Of course, in this process, it is important not to romanticize the community. In certain contexts, communities may be oppressive toward former child soldiers, especially the girls, and they may not want to go back. Any programming must also have a segment for children who fall between the cracks, urban children, and children who do not want to go back to their families, either because they were originally victims of abuse or because they would find life too stifling because of community attitude toward child soldiers. Children's choices and desires should be an important part of devising reintegration programs, and this must include the needs of individual children. In the process of reintegration, the special needs of girl children must be acknowledged. They should not be marginalized, and special care must be taken to ensure that we are sensitive to issues of gender-based violence and the problem of girl mothers. It is crucial to work with the community to ensure that there is no discrimination against girls, so that many of these girl soldiers, some who may have acquired leadership skills, often displaying a measure of confidence, are not doubly victimized. Some scholars have argued that in certain contexts, girl soldiers have an ambiguous experience, a certain agency, coupled with an assortment of new skills that may actually challenge widely held notions of what it means to be feminine and integrated into society. In fact, it is a consensus among most practitioners that any program to reintegrate children must build on their strengths and accept their agency and resilience. I have met many children who have shown extraordinary strength and courage, including Ishmael Beer, the author of the powerful work on his life as a child soldier, and not to mention Emmanuel Jar, the hip-hop singer. Nevertheless, we must recognize that some of them will need help. The research done by the Harvard School of Public Health points to the long-term psychosocial effects of soldiering on children, especially if they have been asked to commit heinous crimes or if they themselves are victims of sexual violence. For all this, we need resources. Though governments and donors are willing to fund emergency relief, they are not willing to stay the course to ensure that children are effectively reintegrated. Child soldiers fall between the cracks of emergency funding and development funding, each expecting the other to take the lead. Most funding is for 6 to 12 months period, while practitioners ask for a 3-year commitment. We need to educate donors and governments based on our past experience and point out to them that the unsuccessful reintegration of child soldiers will have negative consequences. Many of the children may return to a life of violence and crime or be recycled in wars, either in their countries or abroad. I will end with the story of Moy. He was a young boy I met in northern Uganda. He and his friend were playing at home one evening when the LRA attacked their village. They were abducted, and on the long way back to the LRA camp, his friend slipped, fell, and broke his ankle. He watched as the commander callously shot his friend in the head for being weak. Moy became part of the LRA, and after being inducted by drugs and beatings, took part in raids against his own family and neighbors, killing, looting, and watching rapes. After many years of this life, he finally escaped and was with the UNICEF-sponsored project when I met him. Initially, even though a child, he walked in with the masculine swagger of an adult male, barely hiding his aggression. After a period of conversation, he relaxed, almost trusting, and became childlike. His father had been traced and had visited him, but then had never returned, perhaps frightened by the appearance of his son. At the end of the conversation, Moy looked at me tearfully and said, "Madam, what am I to do? I only know how to fight." Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a wonderful framing of the complexity of the issues. And if you are willing to take questions, we will ask people to come up to the microphones here on each side of the room, and please tell us who you are before you ask your question. And just questions, please, not long statements. Are there questions? This is your opportunity. Please come up.
Hi, good morning. My name is Aung Din. I'm a former political prisoner from Burma. And I would like to ask, now I'm running the Washington DC-based U.S. Gambit for Obama as an executive director. I would like to ask a question to Ms. Kumaraswamy. First, I wanted to wish you happy birthday. And in your speech, you didn't mention about the situation in Burma, over where the which is running by the Royal Military Junta and which is the largest recruiter of the Chinese soldiers in the world. According to the Human Watch, there are about 70,000 to 90,000 Chinese soldiers in the Burmese army, forcibly recruited by the Burmese Military Junta. And then I understand that you have visited my country last year and reported to the Security Council. And then we found surprisingly that the UN Security Council conclusion on the July 23rd, 2008, in which Security Council welcomed and encouraged the Burmese Military Junta for its cooperation with the UN Security Council and Special Representative. And even the Security Council even encouraged the donors community to provide funding for the Burmese Military Junta for the mechanism. But the problem is that Chinese soldier recruitment in Burma is never stopped and ongoing, widespread to the especially to the border area, ethnic minority areas and outskirts. The number that the usual this is a usual practice for the army recruiter for many years, and they will never stop. Even though the military junta put the mechanism in place, the implementation process are very much lesser and very much ineffective. Even now, we are seeing some deserters who've run away from the army before, and then now they were arrested and put in the prisons. And some family members were threatened by the authority for their attempt to take their samples from the killing machines. So you said that Security Council have the mechanism to eradicate these negative practices among the members' country. But how you can enforce those governments who will never listen to the Security Council conclusion or decision, and who will pretend that they will be taking care of these issues, but at the same time they will never implement such a resolutions and agreements. So how we can store the chance we have practice in the country like Burma by using this encouragement mechanism? Also, you said about the International Criminal Court to consider case-by-case visit. So my question is, to file to the International Criminal Court for those Chinese soldiers' bodies, do we need the resolutions or agreement from the UN Security Council? Thank you.
Can I answer that? Well, let me begin by saying that Myanmar has been, every year that the Secretary General has written a report on the children in armed conflict, with a list of annexes of the people that recruit and use children, the government of Myanmar and some of the opposition groups have been on that list. So in that sense, the UN has reported that the government continues to recruit and use children. Recently, in the last 2 years, the government of Myanmar has engaged the UN in first setting up a committee to prevent recruitment, and also the ILO as a complaints mechanism. But we do find, and we have enough sources to say that these are there, but the implementation, especially in the regions, is not taking place, and recruitment continues, as you said. So that is our position of the UN on that. This recruitment continues, but the government did make these efforts in this way of setting up something at the national level. The problem, the Security Council Working Group's conclusions and recommendations may not be as strong as many of us who are advocates of the child soldiers would like, and I think that's fair criticism. But of course, the one thing which we have to see is the Security Council Working Group is a political body, and in that sense is susceptible to some of the political positions of the normal Security Council. And so in certain countries, especially when we deal with governments, they are much less likely to move as fast. They will move faster on a non-state actor. But on another government, they are less likely to move as fast. But we remain optimistic that if we continue to keep this issue on the front burner, we could try and move these issues CAFI forward.
ICC.
The ICC, you know, the jurisdiction premises of the ICC is that either it must be the country must have signed the document, or the incident that is being reported must have occurred in the country, or that the defendant lives in that country. There are three bases of jurisdiction. Then the country has to still give consent. Either the country where the defendant is, the incident is, or the country is signed. So it's based on consent jurisdiction. So in that sense, Myanmar, it will be difficult because the government will have to give consent, I think, unless one of the Myanmarese generals or those who have recruited is in another country, then the country where that defendant is could move the ICC.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have been told that we need to move on, but I want to take a moment to thank you, Radhika. This was really an excellent beginning and framing the issues, and on behalf of all of us, thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to have a minute of transition now, and I'm